your computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q1N20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Tonight we're joined by producer, the list goes too long to list, Jim DiEugenio.
I'm not really a producer.
Director, okay. I'm writer.
Really, I'm really a writer, okay? All right, that's my claim to fame, you know, both screenplays and books. All right, now, Len, the Kappa conference is coming up, and it looks like it's going to be really good. Okay, I advise everybody's going to Dallas to go there, and you're going to have Glenda on next week, right?
Yeah.
And she runs the conference, and she'll tell you the lowdown on all the people that are going to be there, and it's quite an illustrious gallery. All right. So that's one thing I want to mention. All right, and remember, it's only 2 months. Okay, I think they're going to be at the Crown Royal Hotel. Next, on the 27th of this month, which, of course, is coming up on Friday, there's a very infamous anniversary. And as Franklin Roosevelt said about Pearl Harbor, a day that will live in infamy. This is the day, September 27th, 1964, the 60th anniversary, of when the Warren Report was issued to the public, that 888 pages of absolutely fraud and forgery, okay, and nonsense was issued to the public. And I want to say a couple of things about that, because I'm going to write about this for Kennedys and King. First of all, on the day that it was issued to the public, both NBC and CBS ran special programming about it. And it was all salutary. There was no criticism. Now, the obvious question is, how can you read an 888-page report and put together a news program on it in one day? And, of course, the answer to that question is you cannot. So it was essentially, and I know this for a fact of CBS, that they had contacts in the Warren Commission. And these people actually advised them on the witnesses to feature in their program. And the CBS program, we know for a fact, was spun. It was a spin job, all right? Because we know from Mark Lane's book, A Citizen's Dissent, that him and Emil D'Antonio, the filmmaker, saw some of the outtakes from the 1964 special. And they said that CBS coached the witnesses to tell them what they wanted to hear and what jibed with the Warren Report. And if they didn't, they did a retake until they did tell them what they wanted to hear. So this is a day of infamy that will be coming up. And by the way, it wasn't just CBS and NBC. The entire media got down on their hands and knees and praised the Warren Commission. The New York Times was especially horrible through Anthony Lewis. Or he was like their guy on the Warren Commission report. Now, in addition to the fact that nobody could read 888 pages in one day, let alone put together a news report on it, there's this. Most of the footnotes to the Warren Commission report are based on the testimony and evidence, which had not been issued yet. The 26 volumes would not be issued until about 2 months later. So, in other words, these people were writing and praising the Warren Commission without reading the evidence that it was based upon. I mean, that is such a breach of ethical journalism that it's really hard to believe such a thing happened. But it did. It did. And as everybody knows, as Barry Ernest said in our film, JFK Revisited, the Warren Report seems credible until you look at the 26 volumes. Now, if you don't look at the 26 volumes, then you expect the whole pile of rubbish, okay? Because there's no cross-check on the information. You know, this is the whole reason that in the academic world, we have such a thing as annotation. You have to annotate your work. So the Warren Commission did, of course, that, but they didn't tell the public about it until 2 months after the report was out. Now, in addition to that, we know, for example, that the Warren Commission hearings were held in secret. They were closed. They were not open to the public. So in other words, in addition to the fact that the volumes weren't issued yet, nobody got to see any of the hearings. So in other words, this was completely done blindly. All right. Now, can you imagine today having an event like this and the press not raising a ruckus about a closed investigation, all right, no 26 volumes, et cetera, all the way down the line? You know, this is really kind of nutty, you know, except, you know, of course, it was a different world back then. You know, people, it was the pre-Vietnam era. It was the pre-Watergate era, okay? And so people tended to trust what the government was saying. And it was a terrible mistake in this venue, all right? And this is why, of course, that the downward spiral in the belief in government began in 1964. And it has really been pretty much a downward spiral ever since. I think when Kennedy was killed, if I remember correctly, 74% of the public believed what the government was saying. In the 90s, in Kevin Phillips' book, Arrogant Capital, he has a chart in there that says it was down to 19%. In other words, it lost like 55%. And on that graph, the biggest dip was in 1964. That's when the downward spiral began. So this is why the 60th anniversary is a kind of important thing that we should acknowledge. All right, this was the beginning of the end of the credibility of the American government in the eyes of the people. Okay? All right, now, what I want to spend some time on tonight is, most of you people know that I have a Substack site, okay? And if you don't, I strongly advise you to go ahead and take a look at that. And if you can, it's very, very inexpensive to subscribe, okay? It's like $8 a month. So if you can do that, that would be very nice. There's a lot of good articles that I wrote about this, but the one that is up there now that I want to draw attention to, people like Libby Handros and Jeff Carter have emailed me about this. Okay. I think Libby Handros of Four Died Trying is doing a part of her series on Africa. And the title of my piece is Kennedy and Congo, The Battle for Africa. See, everybody knows about Kennedy in Vietnam, about Kennedy in Cuba, about the search for detente with Khrushchev, etc. But this is one of the areas that is ignored. Okay. But it's very important. All right. Because Kennedy was very interested in Africa. Almost nobody talks about it. There's only been, I think, two books written about it, at least that I know of. One by Philip Muhlenbeck, Betting on the Africans. The other one by Mahoney, Richard Mahoney, JFK Ordeal in Africa. All right. And they're very important books. All right. What Kennedy was trying to do in Africa was revolutionary. Okay. He was the first president to actually campaign on Africa. He mentioned Africa something like 470 times during the campaign of 1960. All right. He was the chairman of the subcommittee on Africa, the Foreign Relations Committee. In 1957, he made his very famous, justifiably so, speech about Algeria, which of course is in Africa. All right. And in that speech, he was on the Algerian side. He was on the Algerian side, not the French side, but the Algerian side. And he closed that speech by saying words of the effect, if we were the true friend of France, we would be escorting her to the negotiating table in order to save the French nation. Because, of course, the Algerian war was tearing France apart. All right. And secondly, we must begin to free Africa. And that's the way he closed the speech. So for all these reasons, Kennedy was very, very in the forefront of this struggle to free the continent of Africa from European colonialism. All right. Even when it meant going against his own allies, all right, which meant France and England, because they had colonial possessions there, and Belgium, all right, which we're going to talk about now. Now, to begin this story, you have to go back to the 19th century, because in 1870, Europe controlled about 10% of Africa. But just a couple decades later, 90% of Africa was colonized by seven European countries, all right? This included Portugal, England, France, Belgium, Germany, Italy, and Spain. In fact, there was a conference called on this, called the Berlin Conference by Bismarck in 1884. It was done at the suggestion of Leopold II of Belgium, and he sent a congregation there called the International Congo Society, which was his baby. And what he wanted to do was to essentially formally take over Congo, which he did. All right, which he did. And because he understood that it was very rich in rubber and ivory. The colonization of Congo by Belgium was absolutely horrifying, you know. I don't want to go into all the details, but it was very, very dehumanizing, brutal, okay? And one of the worst examples I can think of European colonization in the Third World. All right, now, there was also what they called at this time a scramble for Africa, that is, other countries wanted to get in on the action. See, the first age of imperialism is usually considered in the 14 and 1500s, in which the target was essentially the Western Hemisphere. The second age of imperialism, which is taken about 1870, okay, to about 1900, was much more interested, of course, in Africa and in Asia, places like France and Indochina. Now, Leopold, incredibly, called this country now the Congo Free State, which, of course, it wasn't anywhere near that. It was essentially a slave state. But the thing is, it was the second largest country in Africa and one of the 11 largest countries in the world. Leopold directly controlled it from 1885 to 1908, and then it was annexed by the country of Belgium as a formal colony. Now, Adam Hochschild wrote a very good book on this, which got a lot of attention when it was published. It was called King Leopold's Ghost. And he revealed that when Leopold turned over dominion to the country of Belgium, he incinerated a lot of the papers dealing, okay, with his control of Congo. Now, what's really weird about this is that Leopold was never in Congo. He never stepped foot in Congo. But he oversaw a very brutal and lethal and fatal colonization. You know, Hochschild estimates that in approximately 50 years, probably half or close to it of the population was wiped out. It got so terrible that there began to be crusaders on this issue trying to expose what had been done there. And one of the most famous ones, of course, was Joseph Conrad, the great writer who wrote a novel about the subject called Heart of Darkness, which became a classic. And Hochschild calls that novel the greatest portrait in fiction of Europeans in the scramble for Africa, because Conrad had worked as a steamer on the Congo River and was temporarily a captain replacing the guy who got sick. Now, even Henry Morton Stanley of Stanley and Livingstone fame, he went to work for Leopold on this, doing seminars all over the world, trying to portray Leopold in Belgium as civilizing the neglected millions on the Dark Continent. And Leopold even got the United States to go along with this. He actually ran a PR campaign to get a guy named John Tyler Morgan, chairman of the Senate Relations Committee, to promote a resolution backing up the annexation of Congo. Now, this all began to fall apart, of course, during World War II. All right, France was conquered by Germany. Then the regime of Mussolini fell. So his African possessions were, let's say, discontinued. And then when Germany fell and the Japanese Empire, then this all changed. It all dislodged the second age of imperialism. And new states now began to emerge in both Africa and Asia. And in some cases, like that of Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh appealed to Harry Truman not to let France back in to the country. All right, now this was a policy that was endorsed by Roosevelt, but Truman changed it. Roosevelt wanted to end all this colonialism stuff. Truman altered that policy in more than one place. Okay, Vietnam being one good example. And because of this, one of the results, of course, was the United States ended up backing this new government in South Vietnam. All right, with the help of the CIA, they installed Ngo Dinh Diem, a guy practicing the Catholic religion and speaking English in a country that was 70% Buddhist. Okay, and we all know what happened there with Operation Vulture, where Dulles was willing to go to the brink to try and save the French regime, okay, in Indochina. And when that failed, the United States took over, and that ended up being an utter disaster. The guy in charge of Operation Vulture, which, of course, was the military mission that was going to save the last battle at Dien Bien Phu, which included the use of atomic weapons. The point man for that was Richard Nixon in Congress. All right. Nixon idolized Foster Dulles and did not question whether or not Vietnam was worth, okay, going to the brink about. Now, at that point in 1954, one of Nixon's opponents was John Kennedy. Okay. When John Kennedy heard about this Operation Vulture, he was very surprised. He could not comprehend how atomic weapons would factor into what was really a guerrilla war. And in 1954, he made a very strong speech against Operation Vulture. All right? All right? And I quote some of that speech here. Now, the British would not go along with this, all right? And Eisenhower wanted them to go along with it. And then Dulles tried to pitch it to the French government. They would not go along with it. So Dien Bien Phu fell, all right? And Dulles went ahead and formed something called CETO, Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. And this was going to be his fig leaf for America taking over in Vietnam. But because of his interest in the Third World, Kennedy then not just attacked John Foster Dulles on Southeast Asia, but he also began to attack him on Algeria, okay? And he made a very impassioned speech on this in 1957, which I'm very glad to say that we used in JFK Revisited, all right, saying more or less that it was unwise to try and resist nationalism and a desire for independence in the Third World. It's swimming against the current, all right? All right, now, Kennedy was viciously attacked for that speech, all right? But he became a hero in the Third World because for once, an American politician in a high spot understood just how bad the dilemma in the Third World was, okay? And in fact, now African diplomats began to go around Eisenhower and Dulles and deal directly with Kennedy, okay? You know, they were waiting at his office door when he would get back from a trip, okay? They wanted to meet him. They wanted to talk to him because he was now the chairman of this Africa subcommittee, all right? And as Kennedy began to tour the country in 1959, all right, he began to mention Africa a lot. In fact, he had so many people visiting him from Africa. And remember, Washington, D.C. was segregated at that time. You know, his secretary had to find rooms for these people. Okay? All right? Now, what Kennedy didn't know as the election was approaching was that a huge theater of the battle for Africa was now opening up, and this was Congo, all right? And what he didn't know is that the Eisenhower administration was rigging the game because they had decided that they were, like with Algeria, they were going to back Belgium in the effort of Congo to be set free, all right? Now, the Eisenhower administration did not feel that the people living in Africa had the intelligence or the maturity to run their own country. In fact, Nixon even said, quote, some of the people in Africa have been out of the trees for only about 50 years. Meanwhile, Maurice Stans, the budget director, said he had the impression that many of them still belonged in the trees. They actually said this, okay? All right. Now, this attitude allowed people like Gamal Abdel Nasser, all right, to go ahead and accept help from Moscow, all right? Because with John Foster Dulles, there was no such thing as neutralism. You were either on our side or you were on the communist side. There was no in between, all right? Now, what happened there was that in 8 years in office, Eisenhower, through his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, never once cast a vote in support of African independence or self-determination. That's how biased they were. All right. One of the things that they did, one of the last things they did in the United Nations was to abstain from voting on a resolution for self-determination for Portugal's colonies, Angola and Mozambique. Now, what's going to be odd about that? Once Kennedy takes over, he tried to more or less bribe the Portuguese government into letting those two countries free, offered them something like $2 billion if they would set free Angola. This is how diametrically opposed, okay, Kennedy was from Dulles and Eisenhower. All right, now, John Foster Dulles wanted Nasser to join the Baghdad Pact, which was going to be like the CETO of the Middle East. Nasser said, if I do that, I'm going to lose all my popularity with my public because everybody knows England's going to be a silent partner, and they were the greatest colonizer in the world. All right? So Dulles began to shop around for another ally in the Middle East, if you can believe it, settling on Saudi Arabia, which, again, Nasser was opposed to. All right? Now, this a very important figure in this whole struggle that we're going to talk about is a guy that Kennedy called the greatest statesman of the 20th century. That, of course, was UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. All right. He was elected Secretary General in 1953. In 1957, he was reelected. And Kennedy had nothing but admiration for Dag Hammarskjöld. All right. Because, like Hammarskjöld, he believed that these new third world countries that were gaining their independence could now have a forum, because there were so many of them, in the United Nations. And this would be a balancing act of the powerless versus the powerful. Okay? And this is what Dag Hammarskjöld tried to do. All right? He stepped into the middle of the Suez Crisis, for example. All right, where Nasser nationalized the Suez Canal. And he was one of the people who helped stop the attack on Egypt by England, Israel, and France. And I have to give Eisenhower credit for this, because he joined in that effort also. And that forced the resignation of the Prime Minister of England, Anthony Eden. All right. Now, when Kennedy becomes president, he begins to alter a lot of John Foster Dulles' African policies. He sent Frank Church to Africa as a kind of exploratory mission. Okay, what are things like there on the ground? And Church came back and said, we should be supporting with everything we have African nationalism. He appointed Menin Williams, a very liberal guy, as Assistant Secretary for African Affairs, all right? And Williams said, quote, what we want for the Africans is what the Africans want for themselves, all right? And Kennedy made it clear that Williams would now be running African policy, and with no due respect for Western Europe, all right? All right, and he appointed ambassadors to every country, and a lot of them were very favorable to third world causes. All right, like William Atwood, okay, in Guyana. Kennedy's policy was, number one, we're going to oppose European colonialism. We accept the choice of non-alignment. You don't have to be for us all the time. We're going to institute economic aid to build infrastructure in Africa. And he was going to use personal diplomacy to build working relationships with the new African leaders. All right. What Kennedy didn't know is that Eisenhower and Dulles, and Allen Dulles also, and Nixon had sided with Belgium in the struggle for Congo to be a free country. and they were against Patrice Lumumba, who was a democratically elected leader of Congo. Now, Belgium had decided to pull out in 1960, allowing for Congolese elections, but they had a secret plan. The secret plan was that they would leave in such an abrupt manner, you know, wholesale and quickly, that Lumumba would not be able to establish control over the country afterward. And in fact, a Belgian military commander had written on a chalkboard before they left this formula: before independence equals after independence. So Belgium was going to switch from a colonial policy to an imperial policy. And what they predicted would happen did happen, okay? Because they left so quickly and abruptly, all right, Congo began to descend into a rather chaotic state. And this was multiplied by the fact that the country's gold reserves were transferred to Brussels prior to Independence Day. So Lumumba didn't have any of those assets that he thought he was going to have. So the army spun out of control and began to attack some of the Europeans left behind and to go ahead and pillage their property. So now Belgium did two things. Number one, they wanted to urge the secession of the very rich region of Congo called Katanga. They hired a front man named Mosi Tshombe, and they paid him millions of dollars, okay, to be the leader of this new country. They then began to drop paratroopers into Congo itself. Lumumba went to the UN, asked for help from Hammarskjöld. Hammarskjöld agreed, but it was slow in getting actual troops on the ground there because this had never happened before. Okay, the UN had never sent ground troops into a struggle. So then he went to the United States, and of course, they were non-committal. They were against Lumumba. All right. Then Lumumba did something that sealed the deal. He went to Moscow. All right. And Moscow responded with medical supplies and food. He then asked for planes, pilots, and technicians to use against the Katanga rebellion. And when he did that, the station chief in Leopoldville, the capital of Congo at that time, was a guy named Larry Devlin. Devlin sent a cable to Langley that Congo was now experiencing, quote, a classic communist effort to take over the government. And within about 24 hours of that cable, both the White House and Ellen Dulles set in motion a series of assassination attempts. Now, as Jonathan Quitney, who wrote a distinguished book called Endless Enemies and has a very good chapter on this, said, there was never any credible evidence that Lumumba was a communist. Okay? All through his brief career, he had publicly pledged to respect private property and even allow foreign investment. So this is complete baloney that Devlin sent to Langley. But that was the thinness of the evidence with which the plots to kill Lumumba were now hatched. And at the same time, Lumumba is very unsuspecting about this. He made a speech right around this time period. And let me quote it so you'll understand just how wrong Devlin was. We know that the U.S. understands us, and we are pleased to see the U.S. position in bringing about international peace. If the Congolese place their confidence in the U.S., which is a good friend, they will find themselves rewarded. Can you imagine saying that at the same time that the people you're praising are planning to kill you? But that's what was happening. So the CIA first sent two assassins, QJ Nguyen and WI Rogue, to kill Lumumba. All right. Then they decided that they were going to go ahead and take the easy way out and lead him into the arms of their allies, that is, the people who took over Congo after people like Mobutu and Kasavubu tried to get rid of Lumumba and declare him not the president at the urging of the CIA. All right. And so he was placed under house arrest for his own protection. Hammarskjöld sent UN troops to protect him. All right. But he tried to escape. With the help of the CIA, the Belgians tracked him down and they delivered him to the arms of his enemies in Katanga. Okay. There's a famous film of this, by the way, of him being handcuffed and beaten, okay, once he was delivered into the hands of his enemies, which the U.S. ambassador there, Claire Timberlake, tried to suppress. But you can still see this on YouTube, all right? And on the way to Katanga, he was beaten up very harshly, all right? He was assassinated. Okay, I believe the date was January 17th, by a firing squad. All right. He was buried, but the site of his body was discovered. And see, what the Belgians didn't want it to happen is what ended up did happening. In other words, Lumumba became a martyr for African nationalism. So they dug up his corpse. They went ahead and stored it in a solution of sulfuric acid. And when the acid ran out, they burned what was left of his body. All right. Well, the problem was that it was counter to the sentiment that was going on in Africa. Lumumba became a hero in a large part of Africa. Okay. And he had streets named after him. He had stamps with his picture on it. Okay. Because he, as Quitney said, not because he was a communist or a socialist, but because he tried to stop foreign intervention. Okay. And this was the first of three assassinations involving Congo. As we know, after they killed Lumumba, they killed Hammarskjöld. All right. And then after they killed Hammarskjöld, they killed Kennedy. And it was those three assassinations that were going to go ahead and decide the fate of Congo. All right. Now, the Hammarskjöld case, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right? That whole rigmarole about...
Yeah, there's a very good film about it.
Right, right.
Several, probably. But...
Yes, like Cold Case Hammarskjöld. Okay, I think you can find that on YouTube. All right. You know, that was one of the biggest cover-ups I've ever seen in my life, okay? Because it's very clear now, I believe, that Hammarskjöld was murdered, all right? And there's a good book on this by an author named Susan Williams called Who Killed Hammarskjöld, all right? All right, and so what I think... you know, is so important to remember about this, is, as Jonathan Quitney said, Lumumba could have provided a very good democratic example for the rest of Africa, okay? And this is what we should not forget. You know all this stuff about that you get from Washington about the propaganda you get about how the United States always backs democracy, you know, and the bad guys always don't back democracy. Well, Lumumba, that was a democratic election. That was a constitutional republic. And it was us and Belgium aligning ourselves with the European colonialist power that overturned that government. And that's a terrible, terrible legacy. Even when Hammarskjöld tried to intervene, the White House retreated from Hammarskjöld. Now, as you know, Lumumba was killed 3 days before Kennedy was inaugurated. Some people, including myself, don't think that that was a coincidence, because everyone knew that Kennedy was going to back Lumumba. He had actually sent Averell Harriman to meet with Lumumba in 1960. And this is what's really some kind of really bizarre. They kept the murder of Lumumba secret from Kennedy. Let me repeat that. They kept the murder of Lumumba secret from Kennedy. There's a famous picture, which I'm sure you know about. I believe it was February the 13th, 1961, that Kennedy's ambassador to the UN, Adlai Stevenson, found out at the UN that Lumumba had been killed. And he called up Kennedy. Kennedy was playing with his children in the Oval Office, and photographer Jock Lowe was there. And he snapped this famous picture of Kennedy, his face collapsing in pain, his hand over the right side of his head, clearly nothing but sympathy for what Lumumba had promised to be for Africa, which is a very different attitude than either Eisenhower had or that Johnson had. Now, Kennedy backed up what the UN and Hammarskjöld were doing once he was inaugurated, which was trying to keep the peace in Congo and stop the war and stop the secession of Katanga. All right. But then Hammarskjöld was killed. All right. I'm not going to go into all the details about that, but I will say today that Hammarskjöld was killed, that was not an accident. All right. So what's so strange about, well, not strange, it's so unusual, is that once Hammarskjöld was killed, Kennedy could have just thrown up his hands and walked away from the whole situation. He didn't. He did the opposite. He actually went to the UN and said, "Let us here resolve that Dag Hammarskjöld did not live or die in vain." And then he became essentially the guy who ran the rest of the operation to subdue Katanga and stop them from breaking away. And he approved Operation Grand Slam, which was in December of 1962. They went ahead and crushed Mosi Tshombe and the Katanga Rebellion. And now at this point, the UN wanted to pull out. But Kennedy went to the UN again on September 20th, 1963. And he said we should stay in. And he got this approved for another year. All right? But what happened now is that the last of Lumumba's followers, when Mobutu and Kasavubu dismissed Parliament, they began a rebellion. Okay, and I go into this in detail. Kennedy wanted to commission a specialist in Congo and in guerrilla warfare to go ahead and put down this rebellion. Okay. But after Kennedy was killed, that was rejected. And the United States essentially united with Belgium to go ahead and crush the last of Lumumba's followers. All right, and they did. And I go into detail about how that happened. Now, as I conclude in here, this all ended with the military coup in late 1965. All right. The 5-year struggle from Congo was a free country, to the murder of Lumumba, to the sabotaging of Hammarskjöld's plane, to the assassination of Kennedy. This had now all been reversed. Instead of a young, charismatic, well-spoken leader under a democratic republic, which is what Kennedy and Hammarskjöld wanted, you now had a military dictatorship, okay, which was actually recognized by Washington within 1 week. Within 1 week. And in fact, there were reports that it was encouraged and even aided by the United States and Belgium. That's how badly they wanted to crush the last of Lumumba's followers. So Joseph Mobutu ruled Congo for the next 3 decades. And I have to tell you what happened under this guy. You know, a very rich country. And make no doubt about it, Congo had literally billions in natural resources, including uranium, all right, and cobalt, all right. This was all embezzled, all right. And today, Congo has never recovered from those 3 murders. It's classified as the least developed country by the UN. All right. And this is why, of course, Lumumba, Hammarskjöld and Kennedy are heroes to this day in Africa. All right. And it was even said by one of the journals in Africa, after Kennedy was killed, that Africans mourned the death of Kennedy even more than they did the death of Hammarskjöld, which is really kind of amazing when you think about it, all right? And so all of that, the promise of Lumumba, the example that could have been the Congo, all right? A kind of paragon for the rest of Africa, was all gone. It died at Parkland Hospital. All right. And so Congo became a failed state. All right. Instead of being a stellar example, it became a failed state. All right. And I'm really glad that we devoted some time to this in the long version, and actually even the short version of JFK Revisited, right? Because it's been relatively ignored, you know, by just about everybody. And I think it's very, very important, you know, not just as a way of illustrating, you know, how Kennedy was so different from what came before him and what came after him, but also the fact that this could have been, and Jonathan Quitney talks about this in Endless Enemies, all right? This was a huge strategic mistake, all right, of what the Eisenhower administration, later the Johnson administration, did in Congo, all right? Because it could have been, like I said, a very, very stellar paragon for leadership in this newly liberated continent. And it wasn't at all. Didn't come out that way at all. Period. All right. So anyway, so that's one of the things that I think it's relatively ignored, but I think is very, very important in evaluating Kennedy's presidency, Eisenhower's presidency, and Johnson's presidency, and putting them on a compare and contrast kind of scale, all right? Because unlike what a lot of people on the left say, all right, you know, the whole Noam Chomsky crowd, okay, you know, there was a huge difference between what Kennedy was for and what these other guys were for. And as Roger Hilsman said, Roger Hilsman was the undersecretary for the Far East. Roger Hilsman wrote in his book, To Move a Nation, he said that a very serious problem when Kennedy died was this. A lot of his foreign policies, he was the main guy. He was a guy out on the forefront. He was a guy pushing it. All right. So then when he was killed, those initiatives essentially fell by the wayside. All right. Because there was nobody else there. I mean, Dean Rusk and Lyndon Johnson were not going to follow those. And Hilsman, the example he used was Indonesia, which is a pretty good example. But I would also use Congo as another example of a place that, without Kennedy, American foreign policy didn't have any direction, you know, or, as we will say, any rudders to run that, no guidelines, all right? And so what happened there, I believe, was really part of an epic tragedy, okay, which, you know, once Kennedy was killed, his Congo policy collapsed with him, all right, and is buried at Arlington. And I believe that that was a terrible blow for all of Africa. All right. Now, Jeffrey Sachs, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Jeffrey Sachs, who I wrote a column about, he actually went to Congo. All right. And he made a speech there in which he talked about the assassination of Lumumba. All right. And how the CIA was in on that. And how it ended up being a very, very bad tragedy for Congo. All right. You know, and this, of course, is part and parcel of the whole imperial policy that Kennedy was opposed to. All right. And so all of those resources that people like Kennedy wanted to go to the, for example, the Indonesian people through Sukarno, or the Congolese people through Lumumba, were now going to go ahead and stay in a state of imperialism. You know, first you had colonialism, in which those European countries actually came into the Third World and dominated and put forces there, etc. Then you had it mutating into imperialism, in which they did it through large and powerful corporations. You know, in Congo, it was called Union Minière, which is one of the biggest mining companies at that time. And in Indonesia, it was called Freeport Sulfur, all right, which became an absolute giant, okay, dominating the whole Indonesian archipelago, all right. So this is what happened, okay. Colonialism, you couldn't do that anymore. It got very unpopular in the 50s and 60s. So what you did is you replaced it with imperialism, all right, and then you dominated the country economically, all right, because once you pumped out all their resources, there was nothing for them to battle back with. And so you had all the resources, you had the money, et cetera, and that's the way you dominated this country, which was supposed to be free, which really wasn't, all right? And so this is what something – and by the way, Kennedy literally said during the – he told the British, all right, that he was not going to be backing this imperial policy anymore. You know, and that was a lot – that was a lot of cold water in the British faces because, of course, like I said, You know, they had been the biggest colonizer in the world. At one time, they controlled 25% of the globe's surface. All right. And so Kennedy, unlike the people before him, was not going to go ahead and go along with that. All right. And you can interpret what happened to him, you know, I believe, as part of that stance that he took. All right. As Donald Sutherland said, the late Donald Sutherland said in our movie, you know, the world changed that day. All right. By the way, did we talk about Sutherland?
Not too much, no.
Well, you really liked that movie, Executive Action, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Well, he was the original producer on that. I don't know if we said that. He was the original producer on that. I talked to Steve Jaffe about that. Because he was part of that also. And he said, yeah, Jim, Sutherland was the original producer on Executive Action, and he's the one who got the money to write a script. And so at that time, he left when the script was being finished because an acting job came in for him. Okay? And so they got Burt Lancaster to replace him. Okay? And Burt Lancaster made a lot of money on the film because he had a piece of the profits, profit participation. Sutherland was a really good guy, you know, came all the way down from Canada to do that narration for Oliver's film, you know. And we all know what he did, you know, with Jane Fonda, with the Vietnam thing. So he was really a really good guy, you know, one of the few people in Hollywood, you know, who really stood up for what he believed in. I always admired him, both as an, and boy, and by the way, was he terrific as Fletcher Prouty or what?
Yep, just a fantastic. That might be the highlight of the film, but you know, there's so many highlights of, you know.
Well, film. I personally believe that that is the highlight of the film. Okay, that walk he takes with Garrison. Okay, and he. That, what is it, about 15 minutes, okay, of screen time?
Yeah.
You know, that what that did, and with wonderful editing skill, you know, by those two guys that Oliver hired to edit that film, it, for the first time, the American public was exposed to the crimes of the CIA. And what, and by the way, there's a segment in there about Congo. There's a brief segment in there about Congo in that montage. Okay. And I think that's what got a lot of people angry about JFK, the film, all right, was because what he did by that walk with Fletcher. And I think that's a reason that a lot of people took off on Fletcher Prouty, okay, because he was right there. He was in the oven, so to speak. All right. So you couldn't dispute what he was saying because he was interfacing with people like Alan Dulles, you know, and then, of course, topped off, you know, the nitroglycerin, of course, was when Sutherland starts talking about Vietnam. All right. And remember, this was 1991 when the film was first released. All right. So for the first time. For the first time, not only did you get a kind of topic statement on what the CIA had done in the name of democracy, but then you got this bombshell that, no, Johnson did not continue Kennedy's policy in Vietnam. You know, he actually changed policies in Vietnam. And everyone... How to say this? The mainstream media, Washington, D.C., and academia had all combined to deceive the American public about that issue. All right? And they didn't like it when this former military guy, played with supreme skill by Donald Sutherland, all right, was now telling the public, nope. That's not the way it was at all. And I know because I was there. Me and my boss, Victor Krulak. Okay? All right. And so we're going to dispel that rumor here and now, you know. And, you know, there's a term in the acting field where actors talk about a guy has a part nailed. Donald Sutherland had that part nailed. Okay. And I don't know if you know this, but he wasn't the first choice for that part. All right. Oliver wanted Brando to play that part. But there were two problems. Number one, he wanted too much money. Okay. And number two, when he saw all the dialogue that he was going to have to memorize, and you know all these famous stories about Brando, where he has people with signs in front of him, you know, with what he's supposed to be saying because he didn't want to memorize his lines, you know, and then he had his secretary actually on a radio telling him what his lines were supposed to be. Well, that was it, you know, and as Oliver once told me, it was a blessing in disguise, okay, because, you know, I don't think anybody could have done that part as well as Sutherland did, you know. And so those were two bombs that were dropped on the establishment. Okay. And so they were determined to go ahead and do everything they could to try and discredit Oliver and Fletcher and John Newman and Zach Sklar, because they didn't want to hear this stuff. But unfortunately, it was true. Okay. It was true, you know. And Jeff made that really good film with your help about Fletcher, which I reviewed at Kennedy's and King. And you've talked about already, right?
Well, I talked with Jeff. So, I'll make a link. People can watch it. It's available. It's available now, right?
It's on Vimeo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I thought Jeff did a very credible job on that. Yeah. Okay. And he dug up all these interviews, which I didn't even know Fletcher had done some of those interviews. Okay. And then you got Oliver, well, I guess when he was visiting Vancouver up there, you know, and it's a very credible film. And I'm really glad.
Well, I hate to tell you, but I have all those interviews and I have even more. I mean, I have.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, I have everything of Fletcher's.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know.
So when me and Jeff met over 50 Reasons for 50 Years back, you know, in 2012, 2013, that he started, you know, realizing just how much we had. And we just, it just took a long time to finally put it together.
Yeah. So I would strongly recommend watching that film. I gave it a good review at Kennedy's and King. Okay. And it's really, you know, a guy got pilloried for telling the hidden truth. Okay. I mean, now I don't want to take credit away from other people, because Fletcher wasn't the only guy out there on this. It was also Peter Scott and O'Donnell and Powers. In that book, there's about 6 pages in Johnny We Hardly Knew Ye, which I think was 1973 or something. All right. In which they denied this whole mythology that Johnson continued Kennedy's policy in Vietnam. All right. But then, if you watch the film, when Fletcher began to interact with Jim Garrison, when Garrison's book came out, and then Oliver talked to Garrison, I think it was Garrison and Zach Sklar who told him they should get in contact with Fletcher Prouty, you know, because of this stuff that he knew about NSAM 263 and them. Okay, so that's how Oliver met Fletcher Prouty, and that's how he became a major contributor to that aspect, you know, of the film JFK. You know, and as he says in the film, if I would have known what was going to happen to me, I would have run for the hills. Okay. You know, But that's how badly the MSM needed to discredit the messenger, because they didn't like the message, you know. And it's really, when you think about it, it's really amazing when you think about this, because the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission, that is the evidence and testimony, were released to the public in late November of 64. Let me say that again. Late November of 1964. The first combat troops went to Vietnam, Da Nang, in early March of 1965. A little bit over 3 months. And nobody noticed this. Nobody said, wait a minute, in 3 years, Kennedy did not do this. In 3 years of his Vietnam policy, he didn't send any combat troops to Vietnam. Now, in a matter of months, Johnson is sending combat troops to Vietnam. You know, if you go back and look, it's very difficult to find anybody who noticed the difference. But obviously, people like Krulak and people like Fletcher Prouty, who are right in the oven, so to speak, they would note the difference. You know, and let's not forget what made that policy possible was that whole fake Gulf of Tonkin incident, you know, in August of 1964. Just 8 months after Kennedy was killed, Johnson got a declaration of war. That's what that really was, the Gulf of Tonkin. He didn't want to call it that, but that's what it really was. Okay. Which, by the way, I'm sure you know this, he actually carried that around in his sport coat pocket before it was passed, you know, as it was drafted. All right. And so then, with that Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which, and anybody who reads anything about this, this was one of the phoniest things about that entire conflict. Okay. Because they were, and don't anybody BS you about this. You know, they were provocations. Okay. The whole thing about those speedboats that the United States was supplying the Vietnamese with, because they didn't have any Navy. Okay, those whole speedboats were meant as provocations. All right, and so when the North Vietnamese retaliated, you know, Johnson considered that an act of war, which it wasn't. Defending your own sea coastline and those patrol boats violated those, the mileage there. Okay. When you're attacking another country, they have the right to defend themselves. All right. And so what was supposed to be an act of war was really a provocation. All right. And that's what got Johnson that resolution. All right. And then it was, people don't know this, but even people in the research community don't know this, but Johnson had secretly planned this whole intervention just a couple months after Kennedy died, okay? He appointed this guy who disagreed with Kennedy, a guy named Sullivan, all right, who disagreed with Kennedy's withdrawal plan, to this secret compartment inside the government to go ahead and literally plan his intervention into Vietnam, step by step. We're going to do this at this time. We're going to do this in April. We're going to do this. We're going to push for a resolution in the summer. Okay, we're going to begin a slow air buildup, okay, in Thailand. All right, then we're going to transfer that air buildup to Vietnam, and then we'll commit the first guy. This was all planned out. Okay, and there's more than one book about it. All right. And so this is what I mean. See, Fletcher Prouty knew this. Because him and Victor Krulak were right there. All right. You know, Victor Krulak was a very important figure. If you read any history of Kennedy's policy in Vietnam, Krulak is mentioned a lot. All right. And so Fletcher Prouty, they were friends, colleagues, and they worked together. All right. And so this is how Fletcher knew about all this stuff. All right. Okay. And so the establishment did not want to hear this. They didn't want, and believe me, if I had been David Halberstam or Neil Sheehan or Anthony Lewis or Dan Rather or Walter Cronkite, you know, or David Brinkley or Peter Jennings, I wouldn't have wanted to hear it either. Because these guys were all part of this concealment. I mean, can you imagine the kind of money these guys were making and they didn't even see the difference, you know? And so this is why JFK got hammered. This is one of the, I've always believed that this was one of the main reasons that JFK, you know, was hammered in the press because of this whole Vietnam thing, you know? All right. And let's never forget, 58,000 Americans killed. 375,000 of them came back crippled. All right. God knows how many of them came back mentally afflicted. 3.8 million Vietnamese were killed. And I believe, and I think most objective people would have to say, you have to throw in Cambodia. All right. Because it was the American intervention there that caused the overthrow of Sihanouk and the eventual rise of the Khmer Rouge. And that's another 2 million. So, yeah, if I would have been part of that concealment, I'd be very unhappy also. All right. And when Jackie Kennedy visited Cambodia, I believe in 1967, Sihanouk wrote a speech for her. And in that speech that he himself prepared, he said that the Vietnam War would have never happened if Kennedy had not been assassinated. All right. So I don't know what's trying. And we know General Giap said the same thing to a friend of mine, Manny King. Giap was in the hospital or something, so he couldn't. Manny couldn't interview him face to face, and so he interviewed him through his son. Okay, was kind of a go-between. And Giap said, you know, the great Hanoi general who ran the Vietnamese, both wars against France and against the United States, he said, we knew that Kennedy was drawing at the time he was killed. So in other words, what I'm trying to say is, this was only a deep, dark secret in the United States. The people on the ground over there knew. All right. But that's how bad our media is in this country. All right. So I advise everybody, if you can see the on Vimeo, go ahead and take a look at Jeff Carter's film. I think it's quite good. Okay. And if you can want to order, if you want to see that and then order some of the things that Len has. And Len has a terrific website. What's it called? Prouty.org?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Len has the best website on Fletcher Prouty. And by the way, Len, I took a look at the Wikipedia entry on Fletcher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know how this happened, but it actually got a little bit better.
Yeah.
It's not really a hatchet job now.
Well,
it was a hatchet job. Okay. But it's not really a hatchet job now. I don't know if you had some influence in that or what, you know. Hello?
Sorry, I gave up. I had a years-long battle with a couple of the moderators that, as a matter of fact, some people wrote lengthy essays about it. And one of them was called...
About your conflict?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it was a guy who was like a fan of McAdams who was promoting all this stuff.
Oh, everybody knows that guy. Yeah.
So, but anyway, I just left it alone. In fact, I had started an alternate site, but the code of stuff has changed, and I didn't know. I mean, I had one called Proudipedia, where I just had the correct things about Fletcher. I mean, why people would... anyway, yeah. I didn't have time for the... It's like these guys that are on forums arguing with the Flat Earth Society people. They're arguing, I think Matt Dowitz's site, you know, they're just... It spends years arguing with these guys that if they're not paid to waste your time, I can't believe anybody is that stupid. So I have to think that, people are out there like a Max Holland and these other guys. And then you find out that the guys, they've got 4 or 5 accounts, right? So they'll write something and they'll say something wrong. And then 2 or 3 other accounts will say, yeah, that's good. And then they'll pat each other on the back. And then meanwhile, you think you're arguing with 5 people and it's one person probably working somewhere in the Defense Department, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, believe me, we had a guy who wrote about Wikipedia. Okay. And he talked about this. About, you know, see, the thing is, everybody at the birth of the internet, everybody thought, well, I don't know everybody, but at least I'm one person who felt that this was going to be something really terrific. You know, this was finally going to be freedom of speech, you know. Well, it didn't turn out that way, I don't think. Okay, I think in large part, I think Wikipedia on the Kennedy assassination is as bad as the New York Times, you know. And I think it was meant to be, that way. You know, and I think a lot of the so-called liberal blogs were also very disappointing, you know. And so I
– Well, it's worse because they have this obfuscation. They have a censorship. And imagine that. Imagine the fight for censorship. When you see Hillary Clinton, you know, going on and on about how we have to throttle things down and they talk about misinformation and disinformation – I mean, it's sickening. It's pathetic. And, you know, I have to watch what I say, but...
Well, you know, Facebook won't even let you post from another site anymore.
Well...
You know, because I try and post articles from Kennedy's and King on Facebook, and they remove them within 24 hours.
Yeah.
You know? They don't want you promoting any other site. I think that's the strategy behind it. You know? I can do that on Twitter, or if you want to call it X or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, because you know.
But the only criticism.
Musk is, you know, whatever you say about the guy.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you say about the guy, he does believe in freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, he's the guy who exposed, I think you told me about this. He exposed all those FBI things and the White House things, you know, about. Trying to infiltrate Twitter and not getting certain things posted, you know.
Oh, they were. They had offices, you know, ex-FBI guys. It's almost too long to even think about talking about here. But
yeah, and then who's
I think
that,
he's a hero.
Who's the journalist? Oh, Matt. Matt Taibbi. What's his name? Taibbi?
Taibbi.
Yeah, he wrote a good article about that.
Yeah.
And then he got called before Congress.
Yeah, right. I mean, they had they were called the Twitter files, where he opened them up to several journalists, right, to say go through this, right, and you know, the thing is, it's.
But if you haven't seen that article, I strongly recommend.
Oh, that article is the tip of the iceberg. Okay. Several people have written about it.
It's even worse?
Oh, yeah. It's worse than you can imagine, right? And I think it's what Edward Snowden was trying to wave a flag and tell people it's going on. You have no idea how far down the road you are. So You know, when you talk about the U-2 or the SR-71 or something, they go, do you know, we designed this 20 years ago. What you think you're seeing now in supercomputers or 6G, you know, never mind 5G, you know, this has been planned a long time ago. And the having a Y in the trunks of the buildings of AT&T and Verizon, and it's not, where they just siphon off everything and they figure out how to copy it later. I mean, all these companies, except for Elon, were saying, yes, we'll bow to it. We'll open the back door where you can have all our account information, right? And they're not doing it for the benefit of mankind. So there's Rumble is probably one of the last avenues where you can talk about things. You could talk about COVID.
Yeah, you already said, didn't you, that YouTube was suppressing stuff about JFK, right? And I've heard that from more than one source.
Oh my God, yes, Jim. Yeah. Good Lord, I started an account. I'll say in 2010, and everything was demonetized. We were lucky to be able to put some of the stuff on for 50 reasons for 50 years out there. We did have two episodes pulled for no apparent reason other than they were too close to the truth, I think. And
Did they give you an excuse?
No. And you're talking
They just pulled them?
Oh, yeah, it's a computer AI thing. They just pull them if you happen to fit a category of something. I mean, think of it these days when you talk about COVID and vaccines and just the debate on were the vaccines, did they actually work? Like, how good they were there? Is there side effects that we should have known about? Like, and then you say, okay, well, how about the disease? Was it killing people? Yes. Okay. Well, what's the percentage?
Well, that stuff gets censored, right?
No, I know, but it gets, and then your account will be deleted, you know?
Oh, they'll delete your account?
Oh, overnight. And pull, James Corbett, you might not be, I don't want to start sending articles to read and all this, but I mean, this has been going on for years where they just delete everything and pull everything down that you've ever had, you know? Even if there's one file. Have you heard of James Corbett? The Corbett Report?
I was on his show.
Right. Well, that happened to him. They took everything down. And then he started another account with, you know, a softer influence and a slightly different name, you know? And then they take that down. They just, you know, they are out.
So everybody's going to Rumble then.
Well, yeah, that's where I started posting stuff, and I hardly post anything except for, like, odd music videos on YouTube. But anytime I have a guest on, like, Oliver or whoever, right, you know, if it's a video interview, I will post it there. So, but the idea is, you know, even with X, Brazil has banned it. You know, other countries are starting to ban X or Twitter, right? You know, just because they don't want to lose control of their ability to lie to people. You know, and now as an example, you could talk about the Ukraine war. Who started that back, you know, back in 2008?
The thing about Musk, did you see that interview he did where they actually asked him, they said, if you had to do it all over again, would you spend $44 billion to buy Twitter? And he more or less said yes.
Yeah. Well, thank God for that. I mean, can you imagine?
Because he said, yeah. Look, you know, if that's what it takes to get freedom of speech, then yes, I'll put the $44 billion up to do it. Okay.
Yeah. And I know you're smiling saying that, but can you imagine $44 billion? I mean, and you've got working capital and you're under the gun for, battery operated cars and tunnels he's building and, you know, spacecraft, and he's got a lot on his plate. But in the meanwhile, he is saying, listen, this is important. How is society going to function if you just can't? And like I just mentioned COVID a few times, but there's like a debate where ivermectin, which is just a drug, I mean, when you find out that it had a success rate, you go, well, we should be using this. You know, and okay, show
but,
us the stats.
But it's free.
Well,
that's the problem. It's cheap.
No, I know, but you all think of the poverty of that. I mean,
yeah,
you know, like what? They shut down the country for a year or two. How much? You know, and. Anyway, I don't want to get too, but you know,
see,
the bailouts.
This is why. Look, we can close it out with this. See, this is why alternative media, like Joe Rogan, for example, why that has caught on like wildfire. Because I believe that most of the public in this day and age understands, they might not comprehend it, you know, but they understand something is really wrong with the mainstream media. Okay, and so if you want to get really honest information, you have to go to alternative media, you know. And whatever you think about Joe Rogan, you know, he does have these alternative voices on. It's a way for the other side to be heard. And
yeah,
he's
but,
extremely
you know,
popular.
Yeah, but that's the idea here of Black Op Radio, too.
Right.
What we have. You on, we have people on who are doing honest research, and there isn't, you know, I listened, like you mentioned, Jeffrey Sachs, right? Whenever he's on, I feel it's a treat, a benefit. You go, wow, I get to hear this guy. And Douglas McGregor, and I listen to Jimmy Dore often. And
and there's that other guy, Scott, what's his name?
Scott Ritter.
Yeah, Scott Ritter. There's another one.
And even Russell Brand. Who's on, I think, every 9 in the morning here in Vancouver.
Russell Brand has a lot of good guests on.
Yeah, I know. And then, you know, somebody who I totally changed my mind about, Tucker Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I won't go that far.
Okay. Well, I mean, you should listen to some of his interviews. I mean, they're just fantastic. I mean, you know, he went to Russia, to Moscow, and he had an interview with Putin just to talk to him. Now, if you haven't listened to it, it's no big deal, but you should just say, well, he went out and talked to the guy to try to hear, as a reporter, as a journalist, well, what's your side of the story, right? And it's really worth
I love it when he asked him who blew up Nord Stream.
Yeah.
And Putin giggled and said, you did.
Yeah, okay, so you've heard it, right? You know, so I would put it to you this way, that the criticism that came at Oliver Stone for interviewing him is, I hope that you can overlook that for Tucker, that, you know, if you listen to some of his interviews, like, you know, not everything, right? You know, just, but if you happen to, there's several good, honest.
Well, he had McGregor on.
Oh, yeah, I know. But I mean, that just goes to show how the coin has flipped. And when he was working back in the day criticizing, well, he was on Crossfire wearing that bow tie, and that's where I hated him. But, you know, he changed, he grew, and he started telling the truth so much they fired him. And now,
you mean, like you mentioned, Fox.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then now he started his own. He does it out of his home or a farm where he lives, right? And now so many people are listening to that. Go, we're sick and tired of the I heard somebody gave the ratings for CNN. And it was abysmal. It was appalling. Yeah. It was pathetic. And they did it over a week. You could guess how many viewers, for instance, Tucker and Joe Rogan and these other people get. And guess how many CNN get. I mean, it was unbelievable. I don't want to quote the number because I didn't memorize it. But it was like, you're kidding me.
Well, CNN is always like the – I don't know how it even stays afloat, but it does. Okay. You know, but they're always way behind MSNBC and Fox, you know, et cetera.
Well,
now, Tucker Carlson probably gets more viewers than CNN does, you know.
Fox gets a little more, but they're both – it's like – I'm making up numbers right now. They said, like, if Joe Rogan gets 3 million views a day, CNN primetime was getting, like, 55,000 or something.
Yeah, they were getting less than a million.
Oh, no, less than 100,000. And it was unbelievable. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I would stand up and give a standing ovation when that Don Lemon tried to grind Elon Musk. And Elon just said, I haven't got time for this. You're fired. I think it was like his first interview and he was going to be on.
Don Lemon.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to make a joke calling him Don Lemon.
Uh-huh.
But, you know. Wow, what a public embarrassment that was. I mean, he's like, you're trying to be CNN. You're trying to be your old, I mean, you're a joke. And by the way, you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Also, when they came on, Tucker Carlson interviewed Elon Musk, and it was a very good interview. And on that one, he said, tell me what happened when you first took over. And he goes, well, I fired, we've only got 20% of the staff. And he goes, you fired 80% of the staff? And he goes, yeah, if it turns out if you're not trying to run something with a social agenda, if you're just trying to run server farms where people can post, freedom of speech. And, you know, and here's the thing. If you don't like the freedom of speech, change your channel or turn it off.
Right.
You know?
So, here, let me read this. CNN suffered its worst ratings among primetime viewers in the most coveted demographic by advertisers. The cable channel, which touts itself as the most trusted name in news, drew 83,000 viewers aged 25 to 54. This was in May of this year, from 8 to 11. It's lowest since 1991. See, to what they mean by that, I'm sure most of your viewers know this. 25 to 54, those are the people who buy things. Okay, so that's what advertisers want to know. And they were getting 83,000, which is pathetic. Okay.
Was that a day?
No, that's in prime time. They
okay, so for that one 3 or 4 hour chunk.
Yeah, right. They average 83,000 for that, 8 to 11, you know, every day in May, May 13th to the 19th, which is very bad. I mean, really bad. Okay, you know, but I think they managed to come back a little bit when they got Harris and Waltz on. Okay, they did an interview with CNN, and that helped revive them a little bit recently. But, you know, when Joe Rogan is on a bad night, is getting 3 million, you know, okay, when Tucker Carlson is probably getting millions also, you know, it shows what I mean about the people searching for an alternative, okay? And they know they're not getting the truth through the MSM.
Like somebody you don't have to always agree with, but you go, I would like to hear both sides of the story. So there's like Judging Freedom, right?
Napolitano?
Yeah, you know, or like you mentioned, Douglas McGregor or Scott Rader, or, you know, you go, okay, at least I know I'm getting an honest story here, and then, and you know, I either agree or disagree, you know, so. But with CNN, it's just pathetic.
Jake Tapper's the worst.
Well, yeah. I don't know if you could really single one out to be the worst.
He's
awful.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, the whole thing. And I think when it came to a head when they tried to really frame Joe Rogan for taking horse dewormer, you know?
Oh, my God. That was just pathetic.
Yeah. And that's what it was. And I think adults recognize that, saying, hey, I don't know what to make of these vaccines and things like that, but what you're doing is pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay, Len. We had a pretty good night, I think.
Okay, yeah, good. It's always interesting talking to you, and very historical. A lot of people will tune in to, and with the show notes we have, get to hear things that you don't hear every day.
That's for sure.
Yeah. All right, thank you so much. I'll talk to you in the near future.
Okay, same here, buddy. Okay. Bye-bye.